All right, shall we begin? Recently, the American journalist and author Thomas Friedman said, "If you want to stop a wave of suicide bombings, the like of which we are seeing in Iraq, it takes a village. I'm a big believer that the greatest restraint on human behavior is not laws and police, but culture and religious authority." More and more people are coming to the realization, which is long overdue, that the basic issues we're facing in global politics, let alone individual lives, is the issue of culture. David Brooks, a thoughtful American Jewish author, wonderful, brilliant man, frequent writer in our major newspapers, as well as an author of many books on sociology, has been saying in recent times that the game has changed from economics to culture. "Once, not that long ago," he writes, "economics was the queen of the social sciences. Human beings were assumed to be profit-maximizing creatures, trending towards reasonableness. As societies grew richer and more modern, it was assumed they would become more secular. As people became better educated, primitive passions like tribalism and nationalism would fade away, and global institutions would rise and take their place. As communications technology improved, there would be greater cooperation and understanding. As voters became more educated, they would become more independent-minded and rational." None of these suppositions turned out to be true. As the world has become richer and better educated, religion hasn't withered. It has become stronger and more fundamentalist. Nationalism and tribalism haven't faded away. Instead, transnational institutions like the United Nations and the European Union are weak and in crisis. And he goes on to say that we might have thought during the Cold War that the end game was economics. But he says events have forced different questions on us. If the big contest of the 20th century was between planned and free market economies, the big questions of the next century will be understanding how cultures change and can be changed, how social and cultural capital can be nurtured and developed, how destructive cultural conflict can be turned to healthy cultural competition. Now, I think Christians have known or should have known all along that the issues of life are spiritual issues, cultural issues, as understood in a biblical sense. But we've allowed ourselves to become distracted by other voices. So I propose that apologetics today, if it's going to be effective, let alone biblical, needs to come back to a cultural paradigm. And if recent commentators are all noticing that culture is essential to an understanding of humanity and of the big issues that surround it, we ought to have known this and ought to continue discovering it from the pages of Scripture. And I think it's fair to say that while in much of the past, a great bulk of apologetic discussion has been in philosophical terms, not all of it. But you think of the arguments of Augustine and of Thomas Aquinas, and you think of some of the great and forceful arguments, even in the most recent times, from some of the most brilliant apologists, you think that they are conversant with the language of philosophy. And that's a good thing. Philosophy can help clarify. It's a language-sharpening discipline at its best. The best philosophies ask the big questions and then go after the answers in areas like being and epistemology. And perhaps in more modest and skeptical post-Kantian times, simply questions of ethics and aesthetics. But surely, this can bring with it the danger of thinning out the discourse and forgetting the total person, or as Randall was using the term, the reality of what God has for us. One of the pioneers in helping to turn us, our attention into culture studies was Oz Guinness, is Oz Guinness, very much alive and well. Many of you know him and have worked with him, and I think without a background at LaBrie, he might not have come to this, but after a stint at LaBrie, he went to an obscure college in a town called Oxford, and he did his PhD there under David Martin. And he worked on a very interesting project, which has borne a lot of fruit for him and for his ministry ever since. He took the thinking and the writing of a somewhat middle-of-the-road, maybe liberal sociologist of religion, Peter L. Berger, perhaps the preeminent sociologist of religion of our time. And he applied them to the discipline of apologetics. And he got away with it at Oxford. He had a very sympathetic first reader in David Martin, another premier sociologist of religion who had done the bulk of his work on secularization theory. And Oz took, boiled down the work of Peter Berger into its implications for apologetics. And among other things that he helped subsequent readers and followers to understand is that we are not simply walking minds. We are not simply brains with feet. We are brains, and that, as I mentioned last night, it's terribly important to hold up that dimension. But we are also beings who live and move in a broader context, the context of social relations, the context of culture. And one of the elements that he helped us to notice came from Peter Berger's understanding within the discipline of the sociology of knowledge of a unit called plausibility structures. Now, this complicated term is meant to help us understand that our views and our worldviews are not simply pure creations of the brain, which we then send out and impose on reality, but the brain also is in dialogue with various social structures. And these social structures can add or subtract plausibility from the ideas that we develop. Just a couple of simple examples. A very banal example, it's harder to sell skiing equipment in the Sahara Desert than in Norway during the winter, for obvious reasons. Perhaps a more sophisticated example could be given. In one of his most underrated, and sadly so, works, which was an attempt at kind of doing a C.S. Lewis Screwtape Letters in modern form called The Gravedigger File, Oz has a chapter called The Sandman Effect. Now, The Gravedigger File is an attempt to show how a senior spy can train a junior spy in the art of secularizing the church, making the church ineffective. And one of the secularizing moves is to put the church to sleep about the reality of plausibility structures. And he uses the illustration, well known, I guess, to some, where it centers on the city of Paris. And you know that the river La Seine runs through Paris, and you tend to divide Paris between the left bank and the right bank. Oz suggests that existentialism of Merleau-Ponty, Jean-Paul Sartre, and so on, could very unlikely have been hatched in the right bank. The right bank is the place for the fashion industry, perfumes, films, businesses, a lot of tourists, a few residences. As you know, the left bank is where all the universities are, and the smoky cafes, and the bookstores. And indeed, Sartre set forth what we now call existentialism in a smoky room in a couple of the famous cafes of the left bank. And Oz Guinness suggests that this philosophy is not as robust as it could have been, but it yet had great plausibility because it was given birth in the student section, the intellectual section, bookstores, journals, where cafes were really a dynamic to move ideas forward. Now, the simple point is, whether true or not, these structures of plausibility help or hinder some of our ideas. And this is a God-given thing. We've been given the church as a structure of plausibility for our Christian faith. It's not, as Marx would have thought, in his sociology of knowledge, the reason for Christian faith. We don't believe because the church gives us the structure of belief. We believe, but part of what Christ has asked us to do is to belong to the church and worship in the church and have fellowship in the church. That's part of the way we work our faith out. And this is, among other things, a structure of plausibility. And to put it in another way, many of the structures of plausibility of modernity, which we're going to look at in a minute, seem to diminish the truth of Christian faith. They make it less plausible. They don't make it less true. In fact, as we learn to interpret them, we find that we're in a marvelous time to rediscover the plausibility of Christianity in a very pluralistic and moving world. Now, what I'm simply trying to set forth here is that there's a generation of apologists that is becoming more and more aware of the cultural, social, psychological, aesthetic dimension of apologetics. We need to be sharp in philosophy. We don't want to neglect that discipline. And it has been the great support, the handmaid, as Thomas would have called it, for good theology. But at the same time, we've got to remember who we are as creatures of God living in culture, in a cultural reality. And I think we're making some strides there. Now, this is all possible because of the way God has made the world and set forth his plan of history. A couple of biblical considerations. In Genesis, we're told that mankind was created as God's image. And it's a wonderful moment. There's a pause in the unfolding of the creative process where God takes counsel with himself, perhaps a Trinitarian reference, and decides to make human beings as his image bearers. And so in Genesis 1:26 and then following, we see not only how God made us male and female as his image bearers, but gave us a task in order to put that imageness to its proper function in a historical unfolding. Now, sometimes this task is called the cultural mandate. I'm quite happy with it as long as we understand what's behind that. It's where God says to our first parents that he has blessed them and given them all things to have dominion over the earth, to multiply and fill the earth, and to engage in activities which we now call cultural activities. Now, I'd like to suggest that this, without this piece of biblical revelation, we can't make any sense out of what the world is like today and of our calling and our task. And the reason for that is that it's not only tied up with who we are, because we're God's image bearers, part of which is to have dominion, make judgments, render decisions about what the world is like and where it's going, but also because it has to do with our primary covenant relationship with our Maker. God made us primarily for fellowship, for friendship, for conversation with Himself. And He put us into a covenant relationship whereby He would be the Lord our God and would give us all things with some provisos. And we would be His people, responding in love, fellowship, communication, obedience, and what you might call religious devotion to our Creator. Now, many theologians believe that this cultural mandate had an eschatology to it. That it wasn't simply an ideal program in a so-called state of nature, but that it had in view a future for the human race, whereby should we have passed the probation, the test of allegiance, where God said, you may have the fruit of all the trees of the garden except this one. For if you take of this, the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will surely die. Had we passed this probation, we would have moved from perfect uprightness to a state of confirmed, consummate bliss. We would have moved from a state where we were, as the Westminster Confession calls it, mutable, to a state where we had eternal confirmed life. Now, without going into all the details, because there's some speculation to this, and there are other theologians who would part company, you can gather this from the way the command was given. You can gather this from the nature of the test. The test was to be a brush with evil, a brush with temptation, for reasons that we can explore in a couple of days when we look a little harder at the question of the problem of evil. But there was throughout the Bible, there's indications that the way to maturity is to have a confrontation with temptation, with evil. The way to maturity is not to succumb to evil or partake of it, but is to understand that God's terms are good in themselves, even though we may not fully understand them. Should we have, following Adam, whole debate about how that occurs, maintained a covenant faithfulness, we would have sustained and moved into a place of greater and greater perfection. Now, we don't know all that would have looked like. One thing we are sure it would have looked like is urbanization. Because in biblical history, we move from a garden into a city. One question that is raised, and raised by many different kinds of Christians, is whether the fall actually abrogated or seriously compromised the cultural mandate. And I think the answer is no. While God did not have to maintain it, nor did He have to save anyone, in His great love, He chose to rescue us from our fallen condition. So that whereas following our first parents, everything was destroyed, everything was turned upside down, everything was twisted, not structures but direction, from marriage to work to worship, everything became problematic and ultimately would lead to death, the separation of God's people from Himself, which led to physical death, of course, but also to spiritual death. Whereas that was our condition, God in His wonderful love and mercy, for no reason other than His wonderful love and mercy, chose to reverse our condition and to begin to enact the great redemptive plan that He had stored up in His counsel for eternity, promised to our first parents as a conflict between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman, and an ultimate victory of the seed of the woman, and then developed over the years and the centuries of redemptive history and the seasons of revelation where things progressed more and more until they finally reach their fulfillment in Jesus Christ, the great pioneer of our faith, who would lead us to the eternal city. Now, the reason we know that the cultural mandate was not abrogated is from much of the data in Scripture. Right at the beginning, in chapter 4 of Genesis, the children of Cain, albeit basically an unbelieving tribe, were privileged to begin to engage in cultural activities. So they engage in metallurgy, city dwelling, tent making, animal husbandry, and even music and the arts. Jubal, the father of all who play the harp or the lyre, stringed instruments, and the flute or wind instruments. And while it was a corrupt race, so that you would get poetry distorted into a bragging war whoop, in the case of one of Cain's children, you would have a murderous tribe that abused its cultural privileges. Nevertheless, there's no implication that culture is bad for as much. There is a contrast with the children of Seth, who come and call upon the name of the Lord, but it's not an absolute contrast. Because the people who call upon the name of the Lord in the Old Testament are people who also engage in culture as they transform it to the glory of God. A particularly instructive portion of Scripture which reminds us of the continuing validity of the cultural mandate, of course, is Psalm 8. And let me tell you a little background story about Psalm 8 that Joe Martin knows well. As you have a Christian Heritage guided tour of Cambridge, some of us have helped organize a Christian Heritage guided tour of Harvard at the other Cambridge, the lesser Cambridge in Massachusetts. And as you know, Harvard was founded for the purpose of maintaining an educated ministry when the founding fathers of Massachusetts lay in the dust. It was for the purpose of training theologians to lead the churches and eventually to train laypersons in all of the arts and the disciplines as Christians. Of course, it didn't last long as a rigorously Christian institution. But every now and then, there's a kind of reminder. The threefold book symbol of Harvard is Veritas on these books that are open, if you've seen it in the symbols. Now, before the Civil War, the lower book was turned upside down. The Tas of the Veritas was on the back cover. And the reason for that was the founding fathers of Harvard had reckoned that we had some knowledge through divine revelation, but much was kept from us. And after the Civil War, for all kinds of reasons to do with American intellectual history, they rather arrogantly turned the bottom book right side up, because we now had access to all knowledge. So we're finding that how far from the truth that is, of course, every day. At the beginning, just before the First World War, they decided to build a building for the philosophy department to be called Emerson Hall, named after one of America's great transcendentalists. And it's a colonial building, as much of the architecture of Harvard is, right next to the yard, opposite what's now called Widener Library. And they built this beautiful building. And just before it was finished, they gathered the philosophers together to decide what motto they would put on the front of the building. And it was the days of James and Santayana and some of America's greatest minds. And they deliberated for a couple of weeks about what motto should be on the front of the building. And they came up with the Pythagorean slogan, "Man, the measure of all things." And then there was a pause because of World War I. A lot of people were conscripted, and the building had to stop for a while. And just after the war was over, the next academic year, they come back to the completed Emerson Hall, and these philosophers walk into their offices to work, and they look up, and to their dismay, what it says is, "What is man that thou art mindful of him?" And that's what it says today. And now that they've discovered that ivy is bad for bricks, you know, so they've taken away all the ivy, and it's just right there in front of everyone. "What is man that thou art mindful of him?" Just this wonderful... No one knows exactly what happened. Some probably disgruntled Christian sculptor just couldn't stand the arrogance of these people, and he wanted to leave his mark, and he did. Now, Psalm 8 answers that question by saying in some translations, yet you made him a little lower than the angels, and you gave him, and check the words out, they're almost the same as Genesis 1, to have dominion over the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and so forth. It's a reiteration of the cultural mandate. That purpose has not changed because of the fall. Instead, it's been given a new setting, a redemptive setting, a setting that is just as much covenantal as the creation account gives us, but in terms of a new covenant, a covenant of grace. Now, you trace the story even further, and you see that in Hebrews chapter 2, where the author is celebrating the greatness of Christ in contrast to the angels, and he arrives at a place where he says he is Lord of all, he's governor of all, and in Hebrews chapter 2, he says, although we don't see all of his lordship, nevertheless, we do see Jesus. And then it quotes Psalm 8 and says, he is the man of whom God is mindful and who has been made in his humiliation a little lower than the angels, but now has dominion over all things. And it goes on to develop the wonderful theology of the pioneering authorship of Christ over a very comprehensive salvation. So Jesus now is the new Adam. He's the new Lord, the new leader in the endeavor of doing culture. Another indication from Scripture is from Jeremiah 29. As you know, this is the famous letter to the exiles. Now, the Bible portrays us in many places as exiles. But here the people were literally in exile for their rebellion against God. And they had some years to go before they could come back to Jerusalem, which would, albeit occupied, would still be in some sense theirs. What do you do when you're living in a land as an alien, a resident alien? What do you do about your faith? The intuitive thing to do is hang on there, grit your teeth, don't spend a lot of time worrying about the surrounding world, but survive until that wonderful day when you'll be back in your own place. And that's actually what some of the false prophets had guided the people to do. And Jeremiah writes this letter and says just the opposite. What you really need to do is not listen to those prophets, but, as it were, invest in the surrounding culture. Do it with a light hand, to be sure, for various reasons. But marry, have children, build houses. Again, reiterating some of the same language as the cultural mandate. And above all, seek the shalom of the city. That wonderful Hebrew word, which means much more than peace, in the sense of cessation of conflict, but it means the restoration of wholeness in every area of life. Now that's counterintuitive, because we would think that as exiles who knew we were coming back, going to heaven, as it were, we just would wait and hang on for dear life. Instead, God tells us not only for the good of the city, but for our own good, to invest big time in the engagement of culture. Now, he doesn't say to sell out to culture. There's a delicate balance in that passage because there are dangers. There are cautions. There are limits. And I think as Christians, we have the same delicate balance. We're to love the surrounding culture. It's a gift of God that we are here in Cambridge or wherever it is we might come from. It's a gift of God that we live in many of us in cities. We shouldn't come to the city simply to think of rescuing it or having a mission from the outside to help the city. We should come to the city because we love the city. And we want to help the city become more of what it can be. More about that in the second hour. But at the same time, we've got to be cautious because this is not our final resting place. My point is simply that from many biblical indications, we are to engage in cultural activity. And not to overinvest in it, but to understand that we are still called to enact what we've earlier named the cultural mandate. And yet, this time, it's a cultural mandate of whom Christ is Lord, of which Christ is Lord. And so, it has a new perspective. Many people see a conflict between Jesus' Great Commission, expressed at the end of all the Gospels, and the cultural mandate of Genesis. But I would submit to you that the Great Commission is simply the cultural mandate reiterated in redemptive terms. Christ is now Lord because all authority has been given over him, to him, in heaven and earth. He can undo the seals of the great book of history. And as Lord, what does he guide his church to do? Well, just like the cultural mandate, to go and spread around the world and fill it. But in complement and contrast to the cultural mandate, we do this to make disciples of the world. And not only to engage in the cultural activities of city dwelling and metallurgy and music making and so on. Indeed, the center of what we call the Great Commission is to make disciples. And discipleship is a far more comprehensive thing than simply learning to keep our spiritual heads above the water and the din. And so, Jesus promises to be with us till the end of time as Lord of those who go into the world and make disciples. And at the end of time, the kings, as it says in the Revelation, will bring their treasures into the great heavenly Jerusalem. Well, what are these treasures if they are not cultural achievements? So, the Bible gives us in so many indications a wonderful historiography. What's the biblical view of history? It is the cultural mandate renewed and redefined by grace based in the cross and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, as we pursue our cultural responsibilities, we do it by respecting the nature of culture. What is culture? Well, it is perhaps one of the most complex and difficult words in the English language. It's so much discussed in academics. There was an article recently about the culture of culture, because culture itself has become a cultural phenomenon. I've been helped a lot by Terry Eagleton, who's a kind of center-left Catholic social critic, and many other people as well. He suggests there are three components to culture which once were held together. Now, he wouldn't have said once in biblical antiquity, but nevertheless, they were once together and now have unfortunately become separated. And they go back to what the meaning of the word is itself, but I think they're rooted for us in Genesis. The first component is, as the word suggests, cultivation. Cultivation, of course, is an agricultural term. And there is a close connection between the doing of culture and the way we till the soil in the hopes of growing things, with God giving the growth. Now, indeed, agriculture is one of the major cultural endeavors of people all over the world. Without it, we would all starve. And it is a most significant image. But it extends far beyond simply the agrarian reality. Agriculture is one important component of doing culture. But cultivation occurs any time you invest in this wonderful place God has given us. We are like prophets to name things, and in science to understand how they work. We are like kings to judge them and to evaluate what to do with them. We are like priests to bring them to God's glory when we understand more about them. And this can be true in business. It can be true in the arts. It can be true in every legitimate endeavor of life. And unfortunately, the word culture has wandered from this original sense of cultivation. It's become something of an elitist term. In the 19th century, doing culture was particularly centered around the arts. And now the arts are a very important part of our cultural endeavor. But there was an elitism there. As Hans Ruckmacher used to say, we moved from art, small a, to art, capital A, meaning that the artist became a kind of prophet for his times. Various philosophers from Hegel right down to some of the Victorian British philosophers declared that culture is the best of what human beings are capable of. And they urged those who were cultured to educate those who were less cultured or barbarians. For example, the writings of Matthew Arnold move in this sense. Very helpful in many other ways, but there was a certain cultural elitism there. It was used almost in tandem with the word civilization, bringing people into the urbane place of the city and being the best of what we have to offer, then generously go and offer it to other people. But culture in its more biblical sense knows of no such elitism. It has leadership in it, to be sure. And the lips of the prophets are to be judged more severely than the lips of others, because leadership matters. But there's no elitism there. It's working together, all the different branches of human endeavor. Or as Kuyper would have put it, all the different spheres and institutions of human activity. Secondly, culture involves colonization. Now, the word colonization is not a popular word today because it sounds like colonialism. And colonialism wasn't an altogether happy experience around the planet. It's much maligned, much misunderstood, much oversimplified. We don't want to get into the whole debate about the goods and the evils of colonialism right now. But it has a negative connotation. But at its best, Terry Eagleton points out, colonizing simply means taking the benefits that we have learned from a primary position and going to a secondary position and sharing those benefits, not by imposing them on the people we find, but in partnership with the people and the lands we go to discover. And that's the part of the cultural mandate that says to multiply and fill the earth. There's a proper colonizing dynamic behind a biblical culture. That's why the Apostle Paul in Acts 17 is able to say God made us from one, and that from then we are spread to all corners of the world, and each group, wherever they are by God's providence, thirsts after God, if haply they may find him, says the apostle. So that there's a place for spreading around the world with this marvelous sharing of benefits that is represented in the best sense of colonization. And then third, the word cult is directly related to culture making. Now, again, Eagleton himself suggests that it's a sadness that we too often divorce religious devotion from culture-bearing. And he notes how secularization has deceived us into thinking that we can enact culture without a religious dimension. But at the beginning, it was not so. The whole cultural mandate was given by God in a covenant setting. We were to pattern our lives after his pattern in creation. 6 days of work, a day of rest. We were to honor him under his blessing by bringing back the fruit of our labors to him in worship. That's why when you get to the story of Cain and Abel, you see that one worship act was acceptable and one wasn't. Presumably, because of the motive, probably more likely than because of the nature of the offering, although that can be debated. But there was proper worship involved in culture enactment. Now, if we accept these three dimensions of the doing of culture, then I think we can argue, and we must argue, that our primary task today in the world is to be faithful to our covenant calling as culture bearers. Lots of dangers, lots of problems. When you hear the word culture, you tend to think world. When you hear the word world, you tend to think temptation, conspiracy against God. Be not of the world. And there are many theologians who would say worship is to be in contrast with culture. That culture is almost a necessary evil, or just a necessary step to take along the way to the higher step of worship. But I would argue that we as cultural beings ought to be engaged in these three wonderful activities as God continues to guide us in the unfolding process of history and to lead us into the discovery of more and more dimensions of culture. And I believe that the institutions that we now live in, while flawed and sadly torn apart by sin, are nevertheless institutions that were divinely in view even before the fall. Unlike Rousseau, we don't argue that government is a terrible necessity. Unlike some very right-wing Christians, we don't argue that government should be this minimalist referee, just keeping things going so we can be free to do as we wish. But we could argue that, flawed as it is now, good government and therefore statecraft were in view right from the beginning. And as we move into institutions such as good government, we're fulfilled and enabled better to do our cultural endeavors. The same with other institutions of learning, the family, schools, the workbench, so many other forms, some of them very perverted indeed. But these are in continuity with God's first plan. And although we failed in the terms of the first covenant to arrive at these in a way that was foreseen, should we have passed the probation, nevertheless, God in his mercy provided a way for us to achieve these through Christ in this world with the gift of culture and of these institutions ongoing until we reach the final place where culture is freed from all of its sinfulness and shackles, a place we tend to call heaven, a place we could call the new heavens and the new earth. Now, let me pause there. We have a big subject ahead of us where I'm going to try to contrast or to interface this biblical worldview with where I think we are in contemporary culture. But let me pause to just see if there's any discussion, any issues, any disagreements, compliments. Over to you. Yes.
I have a question. You said that right at the beginning that if we maintain that right relationship with God, if Adam hadn't and Eve hadn't eaten from the tree, then we would have gone into the state of bliss. that this must have meant urbanisation because later refineries existed. But actually, I thought that the banishment from the garden was more of a punishment for not having kept that. So how do you then equate that bliss must therefore have been the same as urbanisation? Urbanisation almost seems the result of the fall.
Okay.
Did anyone hear?
Could you just repeat yes.
It?
Yes.
I got
most
of it. Sorry, I could have done it now.
Yeah. Well, the question is, I said that had we passed the probation, we would have moved towards consummate bliss, which looks very much like urbanization. But in fact, we were kicked out of the garden as a punishment. And I think the implication of what you're saying is, doesn't that mean that urbanization is more of a bleak reality compared to the blissful place of the garden? Let me challenge you with this. And I didn't make this up. I learned this from a couple of biblical scholars. The ideal for a king in the Old Testament was to be an urban ruler with lots of gardens at his disposal. And I could walk you through some of the texts in the prophets which talk about this not just for believing kings, but for the Babylonians and so on. The gardener king was the great image of the rule of the righteous lord in the ancient Near East. So that, yes, Eden was a particular focus where the gardener king actually inhabited the garden. And yes, we had to leave Eden to be guarded by the seraphim, presumably so that we not taste of the fruit of the tree of eternal life in an illegitimate manner. But I don't think you could argue that the leaving was simply a banishment from a place of bliss to go into a place of unhappiness, viz. The city. The place of unhappiness outside the garden is actually a desert. That's why Cain was condemned to wander. It's rather wandering in a not populated place that is real condemnation. Now, just to go further with this wonderful idea of the gardener king, when you look ahead at the book of Revelation, you realize that it is a city, but with lush gardens and trees. You know, one of them has leaves that are for eternal life. So we're restored into that garden. In fact, here's a little moment of biblical irony. I think it's in Matthew, whichever the gospel it is, where the women come to the tomb early Sunday morning, and they're puzzled, and they see a man, and it says, supposing him to be the gardener. Well, it was. It was Jesus, the gardener king of the new era. And the author knew this, of course. And he was going to lead them into the new Jerusalem. So, urban, and I'll talk a little bit more about urbanization maybe in the second hour or tomorrow, but urbanization in itself is an intended biblical development, I think. And the banishment from the garden is a banishment into a wilderness rather than into a city. Now, lots more discussion on that, because they're bad cities. You know, of course, Babylon is an evil city, so lots more.
Do you think, as Western Christians, we've neglected forgotten the dignity of manual labor?
I do. I think that's one of the sad dichotomies of that Terry Eagleton mentions, where the cultivation becomes almost a lower down version of culture, which has its more elite forms. There's lots to say here. One of the reasons I think we suffer so much today is because of the tyranny of industry. Now, it didn't have to be that way. Industry in itself is good. And Jacques Ellul, much as I admire him, who writes very critically about technology, has so much helpful stuff to say, I think has exaggerated the negative role of technology. But he's right that the ideal of efficiency, the ideal of the machine and then the information-based technology that can get us to someplace faster comes with a whiplash, which is not everyone can buy into the ideal. It leaves out the manual laborer, leaves out the farmer. And in many countries, we are suffering tremendously from this because the farmer, faced with the reality of industry, is tempted either to industrialize the agriculture to the extent that it changes the whole nature of the farm, or simply to sell the farm and go into what everybody else is going into, which is industry. Doesn't have to be this way. There's a better world somewhere where we can slowly arrive at good agricultural insights through partly industrialization and partly information technology, not at the expense of the manual laborer. In France, where I spent much of my life, I don't know how it is here in Britain, when you reach, I think it's 12 or 13 years old in the schools, it's decided for you whether you're going to be an academician and go on to university or only into what they call vocational work, which tends to be more in the arts, manual labor, some industry, but not learning, not, you know, elite. So it's terrible.
Yeah. I remember reading Professor Murray at Westminster every year would go to Scotland and work on a whip sheet.
Yes, yes.
Because it's valuable work.
Yes, it is. Yep. Delicate balance between celebrating that wonderfully valuable work and idealizing it. In the 60s, there was this back to the farm movement. Most of the poor people didn't have any idea of how hard it was. If any of you have lived on a farm, you know that it's up at 4 in the morning with chores. And so they quickly were disillusioned with that ideal. But there's a Rousseau kind of idealism of a state of nature, which has nothing to do with the biblical understanding of nature. In fact, the word culture today, sadly, is in contrast to the word nature. Those are the two major oppositions. Mm-hmm. And nature itself tends to have an agrarian connotation to it. I don't know about over here, but in America, a lot of the church bulletins you get when you walk into a church service, in France we don't even have them, but in our country, and it's always an agrarian scene. It's a beautiful mountain, a river. New Haven's going to be a city. Why can't it be buildings, you know? But anyway, that's because of a romanticism. So it's a balance. But to answer your first question, I think we have downgraded manual labor big time. You can see by the way we pay for it, or we reward it, or don't, or treat it, and the connotations that it has. You had one.
Yeah, well, a couple of points. First of all, this whole issue of embracing the city. One of the people I think who seems to have best done that is Tim Keller. Whether you know of that situation.
He's a very dear friend, yes.
Yeah, the Dean of Presbyterian Church in New York City. And when you hear his preaching, it's incredibly apologetic, but it's embracing the city and its functions, and not condemning, but actually building upon that and challenging it, yes. And it's incredibly Christ-centered, cross-centered, and so on, and yet embraces the city as a good place.
It's a wonderful model. And he tells people if they want to come and work in New York, don't come because you have a message for the city. Come because you love the city, want to find out what God is already doing there, and then you want to partner with it. You have a marvelous, you have many, many different ministries here, but in London there's the London City Mission, is that what it's called? And they have almost an advantage over what we're doing in New York, in that for historic reasons they have many, many outposts and places that they own throughout London and are already partnering with all kinds of London endeavors, from official ones even in the police department to ones that are dealing with drug victims and so forth. And I think the vision there is very similar to what Keller is doing, if I've understood it correctly. So, yeah, that's a great model. Anyone else? All right, I don't want to... Yeah, could you? Why don't you stand and stretch? Because I don't want to be a talking head here and overload you. Stand and stretch. A stretch break, as we call it. Yes.
Minorities being right. Brought in Lincolnshire, potato, flowers down the south coast.
Yeah, that's what we have in America. We have Mexicans, migrant workers.
Backbreaking. So, so how to put a biblical perspective on that without giving an inappropriate glorification to it?
But
we all choose to, they kill me.
It's work we don't want to do.
That's right.
Well, the French invited the North Africans to come in the 60s and do the road work and pick the grapes and so forth. And now they're surprised that they want more dignity than they've been given, and it's a huge social problem in France. They're not prepared for really integrating the migrant workers, in my judgment.
Well, we've got that issue over here as well.
Is that right? Yeah.
Oh, yes. I'm sure it's different to France, but they've got, people from the subcontinent, Indian, Pakistan particularly, come across from the 50s and 60s, working in cotton mills in the north of England.
Oh, yes.
And the cotton mill, the industry died down.
Oh, yes.
10, 15 years ago, and so they became unemployed. And some of them gained skills, and many of them didn't. And, I don't know, but you talk about the Muslim factor,
talking
culture now, dotted across a whole swathe of Britain, and the whole question of how a Christian we should regard that in the context of, disaffected and alienated minorities, Muslim, Islamic issue across Europe. Huge question, really, as to how. What sense we make of that, and how we can. What's our role as Christians in relation to that?
I have a lot of thoughts about that. I don't have any magic answers, but I think this is an area where the church has a wonderful opportunity to shine. But it's got to.
I didn't raise it for fear I couldn't formulate the question appropriately.
Well, we'll certainly address that.
Stretch break over.
Well, we want to spend some time looking at some trends and issues that surround us in relationship to these biblical insights. And of course, what we're going to discover is that these trends and issues that surround us relate sometimes in tension with, sometimes as a result of, the great realities of creation, fall, and redemption. Now, there are many, many ways one could understand our times, and many of them are valid and complementary, not exclusive of one another. One of the ways that I think is most helpful is to look at our times in terms of a mode of civilization, mode of existence, with its reflection of creation and fall and redemption. And at the heart of it is modernity. Nothing new here. Modernity is notoriously hard to define precisely because it is a mode. One of the most basic definitions, which is almost a truism, is that modernity is the prevalence of the new over against the traditional. The prevalence of the new over against the traditional. Now, this has distant origins and proximate origins. There have been many episodes going back to the Greeks, and for that matter, in other non-Western civilizations, of a move towards celebrating the new over against fixed tradition. In medieval times, there were extraordinary periods of renaissance. There was even an industrial revolution right in the at the end of the 10th, beginning of the 11th century, and so on. And as the unfolding centuries developed in the medieval times, there were actually arguments about the validity of the new against the old. In music, there was a school called Ars Nova, which argued about the benefits of several new ways of putting sounds together over against Ars Antiqua, which insisted that sounds be tied into fixed mathematical units. And the Renaissance itself, of course, was a remarkable move towards greater humanization. If you look at Chartres Cathedral, and you look at those extraordinary statues around the side of the cathedral, you'll see that many of them appear to be very slim and tall and narrow, and appear to be iconic, fixed, symbolic, and there was plenty of that. But if you look very closely, you'll find that in many cases the artist deliberately humanized the statues. There's a particularly beguiling one where there's Jesus in the middle and then John on his right and Peter on his left. And John is looking up at his master with a kind of half smile, a moment of extraordinary humanization and recognition of psychology. And then you move further through Giotto and those amazing Renaissance artists, right up to people like Leonardo, who was a master psychologist in the arts. And of course, there was a wonderfully plus side to this, and also a negative side, which lent itself towards humanism, at first a marvelous field of scholarship which recognized the humane letters coming out of biblical principles, but then being more man-centered. That Pythagorean theorem we mentioned came to fruition in the Renaissance. Roots also in the Protestant Reformation. Now, this is a hotly debated topic, and the one who came before me in this series, Carl Truman, is far more of an expert on this than I. But there is considerable validity, I think, to the argument that when Martin Luther rediscovered the gospel of justification as a gift, not only did he revolutionize theology and really pioneered the Reformation, but he also made a place for human conscience that it hadn't quite had before, as a minor throne of judgment within the larger throne of judgment that is God's. And it became an authorization for individuals to have a far more personal relationship with God than they may have had hitherto. Again, it is also argued by various historians and sociologists that this had an implicit individualization program in it, which eventually flourished in the 18th and 19th centuries and has gone quite rampant today. So again, creation, fall, redemption. Now, the more proximate history of modernity could be located in the extraordinary movements, particularly in Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries, away from a more traditional understanding of the world to a more celebratory of the new kind of mode. Lots and lots of people have written on this. You could think of all of those who have analyzed the Enlightenment and have noted that various themes in the Enlightenment have celebrated the critical use of reason, the belief in progress, the faith that history is moving ahead in a good direction because of the way things are, and the development of the autonomy of history as part of the way the new comes to celebrate itself over against the traditional. But it wasn't only a battle of ideas. It was also a social reality. It was, as things are, rooted in social realities. So that as modern science developed, as modern democracies developed, you had a social rootedness of some of these ideas of critical rationality, the place of the conscience, trust in progress, and so on. Just a couple of examples, very familiar. One of them, of course, is in the world of economics. Economics in medieval times had been tied to trading practices, trading rules established by guilds, also controlled often by the church. And there was limited mobility and limited ability to leverage goods with a view of profit. But when you get to the 18th century, you find a subtle shift, largely because of deism and other philosophies, represented supremely in Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, and the Scottish Enlightenment, who posited that while God certainly existed and had a vague role in governing the world, the world was best governed by principles that God had buried in it and left in it that need to work themselves out. One of the principles, of course, was freedom in the market, freedom of competition. And his famous theory was that as you develop wealth through freedom of competition, it is the hidden hand of God that is guiding the nations towards greater and greater prosperity. This is prosperity for all, not just those who are the pioneers in the creation of wealth, but through trickle-down effects to everyone, benefiting everyone. You could think of many, many other examples. Perhaps the outstanding example, the one that perhaps matters the most in a direct way to many of us, is the example of secularization. Now, secularization is one of those umbrella words that is invested with so many meanings that sociologists actually are suggesting we're beyond using it as a useful term. Perhaps so, but it is a phenomenon that I think, if you dig deeper, holds some important truths for us to keep in mind. One level of secularization is simply social differentiation. Now, we mentioned that the cultural mandate implied the life of institutions as history unfolds. Well, secularization shows one way in which institutions have become more independent of one another and have achieved some of the vitality that I think God intended for them to have. So in itself, social differentiation is a good thing. One of the outstanding examples of social differentiation, of course, is where the church, as an institution, was gradually, and not without conflict often, separated out from other spheres and sectors of society over which it had had great control. Let me just give you the example of France. This is a quick survey, much too quick for the likes of historians. But in France, as you probably know, it was only with great difficulty that the church separated itself out from various other institutions. Indeed, it took a revolution before French people arrived at a place where the church was considered to be one, I would have said, competing sphere or one competing social sector among others. What were the others? Well, of course, the chief other is government. Hitherto, there had been a strong link between the Baroque monarchies of France and the Roman Catholic Church. And this played itself out in many, many different ways. It's one of the reasons why the Huguenots were persecuted and sent away from France in the late 17th and early 18th century, much to the impoverishment of France and much to the enrichment of countries where they landed. When Napoleon's so-called organic laws were written and ratified, religion was divided into legitimate groups such as Judaism, Catholicism, and Protestantism, and given a great deal of freedom within various bounds. And these bounds were set over against government. And eventually they'd be set over against schools as well. Now, Protestants greeted the separation of church and state in the early 19th century in France with considerable enthusiasm. Several reasons for that. The obvious historical one is that they would no longer have to be persecuted by a coalition of church and state. But there were other reasons as well. They believed that freed from the shackles of an overbearing church, Christians would be able to move about in different spheres without having always to get permission. Hitherto, you would have had to get the bishop's permission to have a job. Now you don't have to ask the bishop anymore. Hitherto, you couldn't have a Protestant school. Now you could have a Protestant school. And eventually they had state schools that the Protestants strongly supported as one way of educating people in a different atmosphere from that of the Roman Catholic Church. Another rather optimistic hope was that now that the Bible was allowed to be read by whosoever, France was on its way to becoming one of the great Christian civilizations on the planet. Because it was assumed once you get the Bible into people's hands, which the Catholic Church had forbidden, they will naturally read it and, Enlightenment assumption, with the critical mind of what was called free examination, would determine that biblical religion is true. And so it would lead to massive conversions. And of course, by the end of the 19th century, these optimistic Protestants realized, had been sobered up and realized that this wasn't happening quite in the way they had hoped it might happen. But the separation, at first, was looked at as something good, something welcomed. And I think we can continue to say the same thing. Now, perhaps in the second hour or tomorrow, we'll look at the depths of this issue, particularly as it relates to Islam, which doesn't have a strict doctrine of separation of church and state. And we'll look at what it means and what it doesn't mean. But on the whole, this is something to celebrate. Now, I know we have to have a break, so let me just get this in quickly. But the second, I think, side of secularization is a less positive one in certain ways. It is secularism. The first you can call laicization, which is the removing of the church from the grips that it has on society in order to free the church itself to be a more prophetic voice. The second, which is secularism, is a deliberate anti-religious, mostly anti-Christian philosophy, which made its way and is continuing to make its way into our society at many, many different levels. And this is simply a philosophy that says mature men and women don't need religion. In the language of Freud, religion is a neurosis. It's a dependency. It's the projection of a need for a father figure to explain the inexplicable. When mature people really should depend rather on science, as he would have defined it, as an explanatory grid. And we live with the two in contradiction. We want there to be the freedom of the church to be prophetic. We don't want the church to be confused with other spheres. We want other spheres to be free, to be normed by biblical norms when God gives us grace to do that. But of course, we don't want secularism, which is a great confusion. More about that after we come back from our break. Let's take a break now. In the second hour, before we get to the fascinating issues of globalization, let me make some comments about secularism and the surprise that it held for us. So let's take a break.